Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Good morning, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing well. And how are you?
I'm doing well. Doing well. Off to a good start today. Can't complain.
I hear for our listeners, Pat had to get up at 3:45 to solve a company problem, which is also 3:45, if I recall correctly.
That's right. Yeah. So a little early, but we're doing well. We're off to a good start. This morning, I wanted to talk through sort of this notion of roundtables, and it's kind of got a couple names, I guess, as if I talked to you over the years, but you could also kind of talk through what Clapham's talked about when it comes to ambidextrous organizations. So maybe just at a high level, let's start with ambidextrous organizations. At a high level, what is that?
Well, it's not original, the phrase with Clapham. It comes out of two professors at Stanford Business School. So an ambidextrous organization is one that uses both the functions of that are aligned with the right and left hemisphere. So an ambidextrous person can use both hemispheres equally well. That's about 1% of the population, by the way. And interestingly enough, there's data suggesting 0.01% of all firms founded in the United States are ambidextrous. So an ambidextrous organization can use functions of the right and left. Now, these professors classified those functions in this way. The right hemisphere explores new technologies and opportunities, and the left hemisphere exploits them. Exploit is used in a positive way. One would be the right hemisphere discovers new opportunities. The left hemisphere develops them. So that's what we mean by an ambidextrous organization.
And we've talked through roundtables and,
yes,
and kind of the importance of roundtables, both in your life personally, but also from an organizational perspective. How would you explain roundtables?
Well, a round table is a circle or a sphere, if you want to call it that. The brain is a sphere. King Arthur's round table was a circle. So you could look at it as a sphere. So there's an overlap in all of these that a circle or a round table is a circle. And most organizations, especially in the Western world, have half a round table. They tend to bias the left hemisphere. So that's why we mean by a round table. And a round table, if you want to look at King Arthur's round table, there is a purported copy of it in Tintagel Castle, hangs on the wall. It's at least a story tall, if not two stories tall. It's mammoth. And of course, Arthur is a legend. There's over 500 books or references to it in English history. And it was mostly made up of four offices that were at the round table. You had Arthur, the king. You had the noble knights, of which there were upwards of 150. You also have who is called the court jester, Dagonet, or what some might call the crap detector. And then you had the wise sage, the magician, Merlin. And so you had four different offices at the round table. And Arthur's round table was, he launched it to solve the problem of a deeply divided kingdom. So that's one of the first references to a round table. They're not very popular in business and in organizations. We in Clapham happen to think they're not particularly well developed or understood, that most round tables are... The findings from neuroimaging would indicate most of them are actually half tables. They're made up of left brain people who recycle what they already know, they know, they know, they know. And so these half tables rarely discover new opportunities or deeper ways to understand what's going on in the business, so on and so forth.
You've also talked about neuroscience, left brain, right brain. And I remember one of the things that you shared when it came to our understanding of the world, our actual, the nerves that experience reality, those are all right brain. Is that correct?
Yes, it's fascinating. The right brain is where we experience, and the left brain is where we interpret. So here's a quick example, Pat. So play along with me, because we've already done this. You've been part of this exercise with Clapham many times. But when you read in Genesis that Adam named the animals, what's the first image that comes to mind, really, for most people, especially in the Western world? How do they imagine that happened?
I always imagined Adam sitting on like a rock and God walking the animals in front of him and Adam calling out names.
That's right. Most people do. Perhaps Adam has even a clipboard and he's making notes. And that's a dog. That's a cat. And yeah, it's fascinating that the nerve endings most associated with language formation are found in the fingers, especially that web of skin and nerve endings between your forefinger and your thumb. And so, for example, what do you see babies do all the time? They touch everything. And they try to put things in their mouth to taste and to discover. So soft or sour or sweet are not concepts or principles. They're experiences. And in fact, if you watch what happens when a puppy trundles into a room with babies, what do the babies do?
Try to touch the puppy.
Touch the puppy. Play with the puppy. Mm-hmm. Play with the dog. So it's more likely that Adam played with the animals. He touched them. And then he named them. And so you can see how in the Western world, with the Enlightenment, the observation, interpretation, application construct for how people know things, which is utterly false. So it's more that we actually, it's the other way around. We experience things, and that all those nerve endings dump into our right hemisphere. So that's what they mean by the right hemisphere. It's a bit of almost a too strong a word, but here's a pretty close way to describe it. The right hemisphere is almost passive. In other words, it doesn't know what's going to happen next, because it is so broadly receptive to experience. And all that means is you walk through a doorway and someone's been cooking in a kitchen and it's very warm and muggy in there. See, the right hemisphere is not thinking, this is what's going to happen next. Instead, you walk through the doorway and you go, and you have all these experiences of humidity and the skin endings and the nerve endings in your skin, and they send those to the left hemisphere. And the left hemisphere takes everything it's experienced to date and makes an assessment and then slings it back to the right. And so the left takes the thousands of times you felt this experience and goes, oh, it's hot and muggy in here. Open a window. And then the right, because it is broadly vigilant, might say, no, it's August in Maryland. Actually, it's even muggier out there. So that wouldn't be the best way to do it. But you're right. It's because they've been cooking in here. So, put a top on the kettle. And that's what I mean by right and left hemisphere. So the right hemisphere continually plays editor, court jester. It corrects, refines, hones the initial interpretations that the left hemisphere makes, unless the hemisphere hits the nail on the head. And these things happen at lightning speed, Patsy. You're not sitting there going, oh, man, my head is bending this way. We're all in the left hemisphere right now. It's just this happens largely on the unconscious level. So the right hemisphere, which, by the way, I just think is fascinating, that why would God create two hemispheres?
Yeah. It implies one is the lonely number.
You know, you missed your calling. You could have written a song on that. Well, it is. And that's right. And since God is three persons, God's never been lonely. Three persons sharing one nature. But I do think it reflects many, many layers of deep, deep reality. And it also reflects, because the right hemisphere is always aware of the other hemisphere, other. The left hemisphere, not so much so. The left hemisphere, findings from neuroscience indicate that if someone has brain damage in their right, so the right no longer functions, the left simply compensates but doesn't really miss the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere is always pinging for the left, always looking for the left. And so I think that God perhaps created two hemispheres to be another depiction of marriage. The great, great, great goal of this entire story, the Father, Son, Spirit seeking to expand the circle of love by having the Son wed a bride, someone other than him, but like him. Sharing nature, but a distinct person, so that two become one. And what a genius way to depict that right in the human body, right inside our skull, by creating two hemispheres, with one always longing to unite with the other, so the two become one, function as one, operate as one.
It's pretty fascinating.
It really is. Wow. You know what, Christians, I miss my friend Mike Iaconelli, because older listeners on this podcast will be smiling right now, because they know Mike Iaconelli started a magazine way back, I think, in the 60s or 70s. He was an old hippie. And when he came to faith, his magazine was called The Wittenberg Door. And it was sort of a Harvard Lampoon, but it was mostly Western Christianity, especially the evangelical faith. And he was an evangelical, but oh my gosh. And he just would ask questions that nobody else was asking. And they used to give out these Theologian of the Year Award. And somebody just said something so loopy as a Christian. They give him they had the Green Weenie Award. They had all sorts of things. And I just find that, he was one of the few Christians who would say, well, but why this? Why this? Why do we say this? Or why does this exist? And I think the Christians really benefit from having more of what is often called satire, not sarcasm. Sarcasm is tearing the flesh. Satire is what G.K. Chesterton, another wonderful believer, did so well, who would find himself often asking, why this? Why this? C.S. Lewis in the same way. And I think if we were to ask those questions more often, like, why did God create us with two hemispheres? See, it's a shame that we can't talk about these things as if we're talking about the real world. But in the real world, if God was one, that is, just simply one being, not three, then if we imaged him, we would only have one hemisphere. But we have two. As if the whole thrust of this great story is for two to become one. Humanity wedding the Son to become one. Or what the Apostle Paul described in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 28. This is all heading towards God will be all in all. Whew. So Back to ambidextrous. I think it's a pointer. I think ambidextrous organizations are a pointer to deep, deep, deep mystical reality.
Yeah, sure. I buy it. Well, the other thing that I've always found fascinating is taking this idea of round table ambidextrous organizations and then overlaying the four chapter gospel. And mm-hmm. So if our listeners are kind of just picture in your mind a clock, roughly 10 p.m. ish, you have ought, right? We've talked about that creation, ought.
Yeah, not 10, 2 o'clock.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You're totally right. I was thinking start on the left.
Start on the gosh. Right. Okay. Oh, you have a tech guy starting in the left hemisphere. How unusual.
Shocking. Yes, thank you. Two o'clock. 2 o'clock on the clock. Thank you. You have ought, and then you go down to what, maybe 4-ish, 5 o'clock, something. You have is, then you jump over to 7, 7:30. You have can, and then now 10 o'clock, you have will. Right?
That's right.
Ought, is, can, will.
That's right.
And so you see a right, you see a left. And what was really fascinating for me is I was sort of entering the corporate world. You and I were having these conversations. It was thinking through, okay, I think I sort of like just sense that intuitively my organization, I don't necessarily understand what that does. But when you put the round table there of king, sage, court jester, and so if you were to overlay those, you would have in the ought realm, right, 2 o'clock, the wise sage, Merlin. In the is realm, that 4 o'clock, you have the court jester, the crap detector, right, Dagonet.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then you go over to the, you know, 7 o'clock, 7:30, and you have the knights of the round table, right? That's kind of what we think of. And then, of course, the 10 p.m., you have Will, and then you can overlay that with the King. And just understanding those different roles, Merlin kind of understands how things ought to be, that wise sage. Dagonet, the court jester, calls out disconnections between what the left thinks and what actually happens in life. And so they're the crap detector. They're the court jester mocking things. And then you have the knights, which we shift over to the left, the ones who can actually get things done. They're taking direction from the king, who's determining ultimately what will be done. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was cool at the time, but it started to really be fascinating when I actually realized, wow, there's seemingly no right side in this company. And then I would look at even within my own departments, understanding, wow, there's very little understanding of how things ought to be, very little wise sage guidance. There definitely isn't a lot of crap detection. But even more importantly, those are right hemisphere. Those are outside connections to the external. And it was like, wow, everything is just this continuous mini half circle going back and forth between the left, the will, and the can, between the knights and the king. And it was fascinating for me to see that connection and understand suddenly the importance of having outside voices, importance of having those external voices that can talk to both the ought, but also call out the fluff in connecting to the is. That was really cool to, again, be able to see this, essentially the behavioral DNA, ought, is, can, will, the four chapter gospel, creation, fall, redemption, restoration, suddenly play itself out into the corporate problems of the world.
You mean you didn't learn this in business classes?
If only.
Yeah, that's, I'll tell you, listeners, again, take the last few minutes and just cash in that. Spend the rest of your life teasing that out.
Yeah, well, that is important, though, to tease that out, to understand. It's easy to sit and think, oh, yes, you know, the system's the problem. Well, yes, to an extent, but also, I mean, how we're exercising things is important. And it is important to realize the importance of outsiders. And that, in previous conversations that we've even had and we've recorded, talking about the importance of outsiders in our own lives, it's sort of, again, this seems like the shingles are continually falling off my eyes, but just this, this understanding of, even in my own life, who are the crap detectors in my life? Who are the wise mentors in my life? And where am I missing it? It's easy for me to point that out in the big corporate whatever and see it in other organizations, but even to see on a very personal level, where am I embodying that? Where am I actually practicing that roundtable?
That's profound, Pat. Yeah. When you were, yes. When you said embodying, I thought, so I would say most listeners, if they've come this far in these podcasts, they would say, you know, guys, you talk about some pretty macro things. So what you just did is, reality is reality is reality. It works the same way everywhere. I think it was not C.S. Lewis, but he said, when you go against the grain of the universe, you get splinters. And so this deep, deep reality of that's seen in ambidextrous operation of the human brain, it works on a micro. And the micro is most people overwhelmingly in the Western world, there's a lot of reasons why, but they overwhelmingly bias their left hemisphere. Upwards of, it might even be 99%. Or it's certainly plus 95. And what that means is, as you just so well put it, you really don't have wise sages, not just outsiders, yes, but outsiders who fit a particular roles. One is they really have a deep understanding of the way things ought to be. And they also recognize the big gap, how big the gap is between the way things ought to be and the way this business is actually operating. And that is, and that applies obviously also to any organization. It applies to the faith community, to churches. And that's, in my experience, that's very painful for leaders, be they clergy or CEOs, or it's very painful to hear. And that's why I think there's the research shows probably 0.01% of organizations are ambidextrous, because most leaders of organizations bias their left hemisphere. And the left hemisphere is, as one person puts it, supremely confident in its abilities, but really underestimates its weaknesses, underestimates. And so I have a little joke that most organizations are not for profit, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, because Dagonet, the court jester, plays the role of the prophet. And a prophet doesn't sign up for that role. And second, doesn't summon up, okay, I'm going to critique this. That's not at all. A prophet stands at the gate and watches as people pass by, but simultaneously a prophet sees the way things ought to be and the way this business actually is, and the gap just smacks them in the face. They don't sign up for that. They see the gap. They hear the gap. Prophets in a church might hear a sermon or a plan for what this church is going to do, and bang, it just hits in this big gap. And quite frankly, that's why prophets get a bad reputation, because they don't mean to, but they come off as this, they're critical, unduly critical, and they're not. What they're really, it's their blessing and their curse. The curse is they're cursed with, oh, guys, this is not what Paul's saying here. This is not the gospel. This is not discipleship. And then you feel in the same way in your business. But you never, this isn't going to happen, to your point, Pat, in an organizational level if it doesn't happen at a personal level. And so I have at least three crap detectors. They don't have to ask permission. They don't have to sign up. They don't have to be polite. They can simply call me out. I mentor, coach, disciple, however you want to put it, a very small handful of people who I play this role as the outsider. But I have walked alongside hundreds who quickly tire of this process and drop out. By the way, one thing we should clarify for our listeners, no one is, and you said this well, but no one is left or right brained. It's simply we bias one or the other, whether or not we know it. We have a bias for one, and bias means that the right hemisphere tends to be very broadly and widely aware and vigilant. And there's a whole bunch of things you can get into there, but that's the point. The left hemisphere tends to be narrowly focused. The right hemisphere is open to the unfamiliar. The left hemisphere is more comfortable with the familiar. Now, we're both and, but you have a definite bias for one or the other. And in that bias, if your bias is to the left, then you're going to be most comfortable working with what you're already familiar with and how you see things working and how business ought to be or how a church ought to be and what have you. And if you stay in that bias most of your life, especially once you pass the age of, say, 25, it's very hard to invite outsiders because your neural pathways are pretty much set. And those pathways are pretty much already framing for you how you imagine business and work and what is success and what is a family and what is gender and what is sexuality and what is faith and what is the gospel and what is discipleship and what is profitability and what is all those things. And only an outsider can introduce you to unfamiliar, to where you would actually go through what is classically called a paradigm shift. And that shift on average takes about 3 years. A pretty intense roundtable coaching, like you've experienced, Pat, for you, after X amount of years to walk into your business and begin to go, and the scales fall from your eyes, as you so aptly put it, and you begin to go, wait a minute. But it takes on average 3 years. And that's why the coach or the guide, the outsider, the reason it's called Merlin, he's called Merlin, is you can't take someone further than you've been. So another reason why most businesses don't have round tables is the outsiders they bring in really aren't qualified outsiders. They're not expert outsiders. Expert comes from the word experience. So it's people who have experienced something that's far larger picture for business. So they have expertise in that. They've got their hands dirty in it. They played with the puppies. And so they are an expert. And today, the classic definition of an expert is someone who comes from more than 50 miles away.
Yeah, there's a great book called The Management Myth that speaks very much to the organizational level that you're talking about, where often those outsiders are external consultants, and you have this whole management consulting business that's developed with many college grads or very inexperienced individuals coming in and being trained how to be consultants for very large businesses. Really fascinating book. It's the story of a psychiatrist by training and then decided to jump into the management consulting business and worked for a firm and was quickly thrown into many situations as the quote unquote expert of things. So he just calls out a lot of the fluff that what you just described.
That's right. There's a good book, listeners. It is The Management Myth. I believe it's Matthew Stewart. And so if you're okay with salty language, because it's funny, it's so funny. And sometimes, he wasn't a psychiatrist, believe it or not. He came out of the university, maybe Chicago, but he was liberal arts, and he'd studied Heidegger. Yes, Heidegger. And see, most business people immediately go, oh, wow, that's useless. And he was having trouble getting a teaching position. And so a friend said to him, we ought to become a consultant. And he goes, what's that? And so he sat, shot out, I can't remember the exact number, say 40 resumes, 40 applications. Didn't hear from anyone except some firm. And it was a British man was visiting whoever worked for this firm. I think they met in New York. And this Brit said to him, how many pubs in London? And Matthew made up some number, and the guy said, you're hired. And so the whole point was they were seeing if he was an intuitive learner, confident, so on and so forth. But the really funny part of the book, he goes, 3 months later, I'm flying across Europe to do my first, over to Europe to do my first consultation. And I'm reading this crap. I go, Heidegger said it better than this. This is bullshit. And he just laughed and he goes, this is absolute BS, but we're making tons of money. That's what I mean by see, an outsider, because of his education, it's a lot like business people would actually benefit from reading Shakespeare, but you're not going to read Shakespeare in an MBA program or in the business school. And so you don't see what you don't see. And so you can't take someone further in deeper into business because you don't understand how deep, deep reality actually works. You just can't do that.
Yeah.
So it's a fun book, gang. And he eventually does give up on that consulting firm and starts his own. And it's pretty fascinating what they set out to do. And so good book to read. Fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in case someone's listening to this and kind of getting lost and, you know, we're so big picture. There are a couple specific things that I feel like I've started to learn how to, again, live this out. One, on the personal level, yes. But even I don't lead a massive organization, but I do lead a team. And one thing I've noted as I've gone about, whether there be planning sessions or just some of my meetings, the importance of having, like you said, trusted outsiders. They're still within the organization. They're still within the company, but they are outside to my team. And so that's begin to fuel this understanding that I don't know everything, right? And my team does not know everything. As you said, we're only interpreting what we can see. And so in different occasions, I've noted, I sense an importance here to have an outside voice. And so I've invited different people through some of our strategic planning sessions, different things, to actually sit in to not only speak to what they see us, kind of the direction we ought to go in, but also to call out if the team's talking through something and assuming we already do something well, I'm relying on those outside voices to, you know, speak up and say, I'm not sure that actually aligns with what's really happening within the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been really helpful for me just on a very, very practical level. But what I find exciting about that is if you think about a round table, if you think about the 4-chapter gospel, it very quickly begins to answer the question to me, what does it look like to bring the gospel to my company? And immediately, we've talked about this before, but that is often, okay, how do I share about Jesus at this company? And I'm still not sure what the answer to that is. But as I start to understand round tables, what does it mean to experience a round table, there's something about this community element. There's this mystical piece here, right and left hemisphere, something about community and the peace and camaraderie that comes about that. There's definitely a reflection of God in that. There's definitely a reflection of the gospel in that. I suspect this is one small way I can begin to bring the gospel into my organization. Whether they know it or not, they are thinking, feeling, and breathing the gospel.
Yes. So twice you said something. Let me ask you, if you want to rephrase, do you bring the gospel to your business?
Mm, well said. No, I integrate it, Mike. No, that's true. I'm only shedding light onto what's already there. That's a great call.
There you go. Yeah. You are. That's right. Jesus said we're to be salt and light. I like how Ian McGilchrist puts it. Here's someone who doesn't necessarily share our faith, but his point is all truth is discovered or uncovered. It's right there. And that's, it's actually one reason why I've stepped back a little bit from calling it the four chapter gospel. I get it that it's a metaphor and it's helpful. The problem with the book metaphor is once you finish the book, you put it down.
Yeah.
The power of the ambidextrous organization is, as Pat rightly put it, by the way, listeners, is a clock keeps ticking away, and the brain is always reverberating between right and left, and the right, because it is receptive, our impressions about the way the world ought to be come far more from the millions and billions and trillions of experiences we have than what you hear for 30 minutes in a sermon. They shape your moral imagination, ought. And they also, therefore, give you this sense of the way it is. The left hemisphere simply takes that and goes, well, here's what we can do about that. And here's what will come out of it. But this is kind of going back and forth and back and forth. And the upside of an ambidextrous is the right side, the outsiders, as Pat correctly noted, would go, well, I'm not sure that's the way business ought to be. Are you sure about that? What about this? Are you really sure we bring the gospel, for example? See how the right works just even right now. And those who bias their left, and that's Pat's gift, that he does bias the left more, is he's now thinking more ambidextrously because he goes, that's true. That's right. That's not. And again, listeners, if some of you are going, well, come on, we're just talking semantics here. Go back and read Genesis 1. God creates by rightly defining reality. Then go read Ezekiel and Isaiah and discover why Lucifer fell. He used words that did not rightly define reality. I will ascend to the Most High. I will be exalted. The initial thrust of individualism, all before time and space were created. And so Lucifer, the most cunning and brilliant being ever made, doesn't go around with a red tail and a red jumpsuit, but is more whispers in your ear, this is the way business ought to be. This is the way a family ought to be. This is the gospel. As you think about it, all he does with Eve is he takes everything or a lot of what God said and he just twists it and says, you will become like the Most High. You will become like God. Just do this. He's not stupid, in other words, and he's not obvious. And he's been around longer than we have. And so this ambidextrous, this willingness to hear the outside, is one of the ways we actually unmask Lucifer. And on a personal level then, let's set it, you're right, Pat, let's set aside the macro. I often ask people, so tell me, who are your outsiders, your court jesters, your crap detectors? Can you give me name, mobile number, email address? I'll give them a call. See if, in fact, they feel that way. Very few ever take me up on that. Very few. And the few who ever have, when I contact the outsider, they're not really an outsider because they aren't taking that person further than they have been because they haven't gone further themselves. And so what they do as an outsider, And this is what you correctly note about most outside consultants. They simply confirm what a group already believes and then tries to come up with some kind of better way to do what they already believe. That's why the subtitle on that book, The Management Myth, is Why the Experts Keep Getting It Wrong.
Yeah, that's a really well said. One, if listeners didn't pick up on it earlier, that was sort of a textbook example of crap detector outsider when Mike essentially said, wait a sec, do you want to rephrase that? Maybe you should try rephrasing that. And I mean, that is one of the, honestly, one of the most enjoyable things I've come to find in our relationship is not only those things, but also, man, the freedom to be corrected. I just never, I never was okay with that before, in that probably insecurity is a snap, but just the freedom and the humility that comes with correction after correction after correction. The amount of times Mike said, I'm not sure about that, or you might want to rephrase that, has been awesome, because it naturally begins to fuel a sense of humility, a sense of even just not taking yourself so seriously. And again, I think if organizations begin to operate that way, if teams begin to operate that way, heck, if just people in general, Christians specifically, were to operate that way, it's just more fun. Life's just
it is more fun.
Yeah,
that's why he was called the court jester. It's why in Mario Puzo's series The Godfather, there was called the consigliere, was someone who could call out the mafia don that say he was full of crap and didn't risk having his head cut off. They didn't do that because they took seriously, I believe it's Hans Christian Andersen's famous tale about the emperor. What was that all about? The emperor's new clothes. What was that all about?
I'm not sure. I mean, there's a Disney movie about it.
Well, I doubt it's as good as the original, because remember, he goes out, and because the emperor only wants to hear what he wants to hear, he asks for a new set of clothes, and they don't stitch anything on him. And when he goes out, it's only a little boy who goes, he's naked. But everybody else, see, listeners, we're not setting up, Mike Metzger is the all-in-all and Pat Brown is the quintessential example of a well-rounded human being.
Yeah, I sure hope.
I mean, first of all, get our wires in here. But the fact of the matter is, Pat, you are unique, at least in my experience, and others who play the role that I play, is very few people. In fact, very few marriages even have this, because a court jester doesn't have to be polite. They have to be respectful. They should have a sense of humor. They don't have to preface. So they don't have to say, Pat, I don't want to hurt your feelings. And I don't want to invade your space. And I want you to feel safe with me, do we really bring the gospel, Pat? What do you think, huh? See, that's not. I'm always reminded of Mr. Beaver when the kids begin to discover, or they hear about Aslan, and they go, "Lion? Well, is he safe?" Mr. Beaver is incredulous. Safe? Who said anything about safe? He's good. God is not safe. God is good. And if he's truly good, then you don't think about safe. I respectfully suggest to my friends, church is not supposed to be a safe place. If you're looking for a safe God, then you're looking for a left-brain God who will never unsettle your settled assumptions about God, the gospel, reality, discipleship, worship. You'll just keep recycling what you've always assumed is the case and just keep hearing what you want to hear. But I would recommend, by the way, a really fascinating book on this. It was written by Philip Yancey many, many years ago. It's called Pain, The Gift Nobody Wants. It was co-written with Paul Brand. Paul Brand, Dr. Brand, was raised as a missionary, but he also worked in the last leprosarium in the United States. That's right. There were people who had leprosy in the 20th century. And the leprosarium was in Carville, Louisiana, not far from Baton Rouge, where Kathy and I lived for many years. I remember driving by a little sign for the Carville Hospital. And Paul dedicated his life to trying to find ways to heal lepers. When the discoveries were primarily leprosy is a loss of pain sensations, especially in your extremities, toes, fingers, elbow, nose, lips. And the loss of those pain sensors is you can then place your hand on a hot stove and it's not till you smell the burning flesh that you're aware that you're burning your flesh. And so he tried to spend his life dedicated to trying to create artificial pain sensors so that lepers would not self-destroy. Oh, it's one particularly sad story of a man who kept breaking his ankles. And they finally felt they had developed this shoe, I believe it was. And as he walks away, he watches the man. There's a some kind of slip in the shoe. The ankle breaks. He's walking on the end of his tibia or fibula and is unaware. So the disfigurement from leprosy is the loss of pain sensors. But here's the fascinating thing Yancey points out that he learned from Paul Brand. Pain is a gift. Especially, particularly, and you think about it, even if we hadn't fallen, do you mean Adam and Eve would walk around and say a rose fell, a rose bush, they would eventually die, and you step on a thorn, you wouldn't feel any pain? Oh, look, I stepped on a thorn, nothing happened. So pain is a gift, and it is painful to have prophets and priests in your life, those who bias the right hemisphere, who tell you painful truths. But Yancey learned this from Brand. And here's what the science has told us. The more pain that you can endure, the more pain you can endure. The more pain you experience, profitable pain, that is, the more pain you can endure. And Yancey, I think in the book, this is a 25, 30-year-old book, speculates that in a medicated Western world, 95%, for example, of the psychotropic drugs that are taken, medications that are taken in the world are taken in the United States. As we medicate away from pain, we have less tolerance for pain. And any pain, even someone perhaps saying, your shirt and your pants don't match, Mike. Go upstairs and change. I'm quoting my wife. It can be as simple as that. And there's just something inside you goes, And I see this all the time with Christians. You might suggest, are we really supposed to manage people? And you get this, the arched brow of suspicion, I call it. Like, well, what are you saying? And what they're saying is, ouch, I mean, that hurt a little bit. Are you questioning me? Are you questioning my faith? And what you've come through, Pat, is it takes on average at least 3 years to where you can get to the point where you feel naked if you haven't heard anything painful in a while. And that's the point of the Emperor's New Clothes, is you can get to the point where you're naked and you don't know it.
Yeah, wow. It's very...
So I feel it. In businesses, what we do is called Pixar reviews. It's built based off of what Disney did when and Pixar did when they, especially for many years, and then they bought Disney and they introduced Disney to Pixar. And Pixar was at the end of every film, you had to write five things that went well in the process. The entire team had to get together. Five things that went well and five things that stunk. And it was brutally honest. But that's what catapulted Disney out of 20 years of doldrums. Because Pixar said, gosh, when Pixar came into Disney, they said, Disney up at that point would create a film. Then everyone would backslap each other. Great job. Just watch sales. And that was gone. They were done. Then they really lost their creative edge. And Pixar introduced these reviewers where the whole development team didn't leave the room until they came up with five things that went well and five things that stunk. I've found businesses that I've introduced businesses to this, and a select few actually stick with it. Every meeting, every project. But the vast majority get tired of doing it within a few months. I've introduced churches to this for their sermon preparation. The vast majority within a year get tired of it. The first clue is they soften the Pixar to three or five things that went well and three things that we could improve on. Well, that's not what a Pixar does, because what it doesn't say is it's now softening the blow of pain. And when you soften the blow, you begin to feel, yeah, it wasn't as bad as that outsider said.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. And only person you're hurting, like the leper, is yourself. This is why ambidextrous organizations is what you and I and a bunch of us are committed to, because they're extremely rare. I think they actually depict the gospel. They are how people, I've personally seen over the last 20 years, how they discover the gospel right there in their midst. It's how their performance in their workplace improves. It just simply aligns with the universe and the way God created the universe to rotate.
So one thing I'm really curious your take on this, Mike, but we're just a little teaser, because we'll probably, I imagine we'll have to go full depth into this next week, but how does dominion fit into this?
Yeah, we'll have to. Dominion, a simple way I think of it is influence or cultural capital would be another. For example, economic capital would say, if you look at a house and it's a $500,000 house and you make $22,000, the bank's going to say, sorry, you don't have enough capital to purchase this. So you don't have dominion. You can't say, well, I'm going to buy this house no matter what. No, you're not. Unless you can come up with the cash. No, you're not. So dominion is in a business, as where you work, Pat, is earning cultural capital. And we will talk about next time that the last 200 years in the, and I'm going to quote James Hunter in his book, To Change the World. The last 200 years, the history of the conservative faith traditions in Europe and America is of increasingly lost cultural capital or influence or dominion. It is precipitously declining. So that means, for example, that your C-level leadership in your company, when they're wondering what they ought to do to address XYZ problem, they don't turn to the faith community and say, well, let's get Pat's pastor in here and ask him, because he could take us further in to how business ought to be and what we might do that would be wise. Now, so that's what we mean by dominion. It's earned. And for if listeners think you're hearing works salvation, you're not. That's not what we're talking about at all. What we're talking about is just as we work out our salvation in fear and trembling, in the same way, cultural capitalist is not given to you because you're a Christian. It is earned, and it's earned by having a better model for how the world ought to be, embodying that because you have learned it from somebody else who embodies it, who has gone further. And so they have taken you further. And when you talk, business leaders hear you and go, I want to hear more. Where'd you get that? That's fascinating. That let's go in that direction. Let's see if that is in fact a better way to do it. That's having dominion. In our work, I'm dedicating the rest of my life to helping as many young emerging leaders like you to earn capital, cultural capital in your businesses, or dominion or influence, so that people can rediscover the gospel that is already there in their business.